charismatic, passionate, has integrity, humble, servant, inspiring, faithful, persevering, positive, flexible, driven.
This is not about theory. This is about application. This is what you're trying to be. This is who we are that call ourselves leaders.
I'm Dave Ramsey, and you're listening to the Entree Leadership Podcast.
Hey guys, this is Christy Wright, and I am excited to be back with you today on today's podcast. You know, we just wrapped up our Leaders, Our Readers Month, and I'll be honest, I'm really excited about today's author. Stephen M. R. Covey is best-selling author of the book Smart Trust, and we actually had him as a guest on our podcast about a year ago, and we just barely got into the content of this book. So I'm excited today to unpack it a little bit more for you, give some real tangible principles about how to implement this in your business, but also just use this in your life. So let's jump right in. Well, Stephen, how are you today?
I'm doing terrific. How are you doing, Christy?
I'm great. Thanks so much for being with us today. You know, I'm so excited to dive right into this book. Tell me about this idea of smart trust and why it's so important to have it in our businesses and in the marketplace.
Well, you know, it was Warren Buffett who said this. He said, trust is like the air that we breathe. When it's present, nobody really notices. But when it's absent, everybody notices.
Mm.
And that's kind of what's happening today, is that we're seeing a loss of trust, and in many respects, a crisis of trust, as trust has gone down in business, in government, in different aspects of society. And suddenly, people are becoming aware of this trust issue, that the air is polluted, if you will. And as you gain that awareness, you start to realize, hey, there is a high cost to low trust.
Mm.
Because when there's low trust, either whether it be in a relationship or on a team or in a company, in a culture or with customers, when there's low trust, speed goes down. That is, everything will take you longer to do, and cost goes up. Everything costs you more to do. Why? Because you got to take all those steps to compensate for that lack of trust. But the good news is that the converse is equally true, and that is, when you can increase trust in a relationship, on a team, in a company, in a culture, with a customer, when you increase the trust, the speed goes up with it. Everything happens faster, and the cost comes down. It costs you less. And that is the dividend, the high trust dividend. So that's the idea.
Yeah. So do you think, in your experience, that people in businesses or even relationships or the government, do you think they're aware that trust is the issue, or do they just realize something is broken? Like, are they aware that this idea of trust is what's causing this that you're describing?
I don't think they're aware of it. I think they realize something's broken and they can't pinpoint
right.
it. Right. And that's you know, there's also this proverb that says that fish are the very last to discover water. And it's because the fish are so immersed in it,
right.
all that they've known, they're not even aware of it, so to speak. And same with us, people. We're often the last to discover trust, because it's so much part of how our life works and how the world goes round that we're not even aware of it. But so many issues are really at their core trust issues.
Mm.
We just never saw them that way. But when you kind of peel away the onion and look at what the underlying issue, so often it's a trust issue. And it might look like, hey, we got an engagement issue, our people aren't engaged, or people, no one collaborates, and no one partners in teams. And okay, but keep peeling the onion. And as you do that, you realize the problem is there's low trust. People don't trust each other. And it's hard for people, for example, to collaborate if they don't trust each other. You know, you can coordinate if people don't trust each other, but real collaboration requires trust.
Right.
Same thing with innovation. You very rarely will see an innovation culture in a low trust environment. And so this trust is foundational, but I think you've identified it exactly, is that so often we just don't think of it in terms of trust, but when you really stand back and look at it and peel the onion, so many issues at their core are trust issues. And sometimes it just takes putting on the trust glasses. I like to use that metaphor I was on a river fly fishing, and I couldn't see anything through the water, and my guide that was with me had these polarized sunglasses on.
Mm-hmm.
And he could see all these fish below the surface. I couldn't see anything. And he said, hey, there's fish everywhere. And I said, really? And I said, yeah. And he said, here, put these on. So he handed me his polarized sunglasses. The moment I put the glasses on, I could see the fish everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, the fish were always there. I just couldn't see them until I put those glasses on. And same with trust. There's trust issues everywhere, but sometimes it takes putting on the glasses to see them. And then once we see them, suddenly the whole world changed. And we say, gosh, I didn't realize, but this is a trust issue. And I think that is a big part of the problem. We haven't pinpointed it.
Right. No, I think I agree completely. It's interesting because trust is such a strong motivator for us as humans, whether that's in positive or negative ways. And so the way that you're describing it, it's all around us, but because we're in it so deeply every day, it's difficult to identify it. And I think this is such a great topic for our audience because business leaders, if you really want to succeed in leadership, you've got to operate at that foundational level, like you're describing. You've got to get to the issue behind the issue and really work on those strong motivations that people have if you're going to make change. Because you can't just stay at the surface. It's going to keep happening, right?
You're exactly right. You got to get to the root causes and go beneath the surface and to really get to what's going on. I like what you just said there, Christy, that trust is such a motivator. It really is. I like to put it this way, that to be trusted is the most compelling form of human motivation.
Mm.
It inspires people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It brings out the best in people. And most people will rise to the occasion, and they'll perform better. They want to prove the trust justified. They want to give it back. Now, there always may be a few people that will abuse the trust, you know, take advantage of it. But what we shouldn't do is allow the 5% of the people that violate our trust to define for us the 95% of the people that will be inspired by it.
Oh, that's good.
And you know, it's far better to design our organizations for the 95% that we can trust, and not for the 5% that we can't. And then allow the culture, you know, build a high-trust culture, allow the culture to weed out, to crowd out, to starve out the 5%, instead of penalizing the many because of the few.
Right.
And that's what leaders can do. And that's what I love about your audience is, you know, this is entre leadership. And so these are leaders that are trying to bring out the best in people. And nothing inspires people like being trusted. And the job of a leader is to go first, is to lead out. And you know, I think the first job of a leader is to inspire trust so that people look at that person, at him or her, and say, this is a person I can trust. They inspire it in who they are, in their character, in their competence. That's the first job, to inspire trust. But the second job of a leader is to extend trust, to give it. And the reason that's so important is because there's a reciprocity to trust, meaning this, that when you give it, people receive it, and they return it. But when you withhold it, they withhold it. You know, it's interesting, Christy. One reason why in many organizations today that employees don't trust their management is really simply because the management doesn't trust the employees. And the employees reciprocate that distrust right back at them. And the same thing can happen with customers or with partners. If you don't trust them, they'll tend to not trust you. But when you do trust them, they tend to receive it and return it. There's a reciprocity to trust.
Mm.
And so the key learning is this. If you want to be trusted as a leader, you've got to give trust.
Mm.
You've got to give it to get it. And you got to be smart about it. I'm not saying a blind trust where you
sure.
just indiscriminately trust anyone and everyone. But what I call a smart trust, where you're giving it very specifically, very consciously. But you recognize that when you give trust, people receive it and they return it and they're inspired by it and it brings out the best in them.
Right. And it almost becomes the way that you're describing it, almost becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. If you don't trust,
beautiful.
So you withhold trust, then other people react accordingly. But you actually led that by your actions. And it makes me think of in action point number 3, where you say, declare your intent and assume positive intent in others. And I love that because I think you said somewhere else in the book where, you know, we tend to judge ourselves by our intent and our, you know, our good intentions, but then we judge others by their behavior. And so if we keep that in mind and thinking, okay, others are judging me by my behavior, and so I can kind of clear the air by declaring my intent, as you say it. Here's why I'm bringing this to the table. Here's why this next initiative is important. Then it takes away any room for assumption or miscommunication on their yep. end. But then at the same time, when you say assume positive intent in others, I love that my pastor, his name's Pete Wilson, he has a quote that he says, believe the best. In the absence of information, believe the best. And it kind of goes along with this self-fulfilling prophecy, because if you believe the best, then you respond to people according to that baseline, and you're happy and you're open and you're trusting and you're engaging. But the opposite is also true. If you assume the worst, then you are defensive and you come up with scenarios in your head that that person's probably mad at you. So when you see them, you react as if they're mad at you, and then they become defensive, and it's this cycle in the opposite direction. So it seems like all of that kind of supports what you're saying of this self-fulfilling prophecy by how you lead, and it starts with you.
Beautiful. I love that. And you're exactly right. That the self-fulfilling prophecy works in either direction, as you're pointing out. And when you give the trust, people receive it, they return it, they're inspired by it, they rise to the occasion, they perform better, and then you say, gosh, yeah, look how they respond, you give them more trust, and it becomes that virtuous upward cycle, and that's part of the self-fulfilling prophecy. And when you withhold it, they withhold it, and they kind of become more careful, cautious, guarded, they don't trust you back, you don't trust them, you find the evidence that you shouldn't be trusting them, and you go down that vicious downward cycle. Mm-hmm. And so, you're exactly right. Trust is contagious in either direction. Trust is contagious, and so is distrust. And you'll get the virtuous upward cycle or the vicious downward cycle, which is the self-fulfilling prophecy.
Right.
One of the best things I know is to always declare your intent. So you let people know what you're doing, but also why you're doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Always give the why behind the what. Sometimes people give the what, they don't give the why. But the why is vital. It gives you context. It gives you meaning. And it's like with your colleagues, with your peers, with the people that you lead, it's always better to assume positive intent until they give you reason not to. And you'll find you'll go farther, faster. And so there's a lot of leverage in that idea of intent on both sides, to declare your intent and to assume positive intent for any leader.
I would think that would be so helpful, too, for a lot of these leaders in organizations and businesses, to this piece about declaring your intent and the why, because in my experience, that gets such a higher level of buy-in and loyalty for your initiatives, rather than going into a meeting and saying, hey, I'm going to need everyone to work an extra 20 hours a week for the next 3 months. Thanks, see you later. It's like, hey, we're going to run towards this finish line, and here's where we're going to get, and here's the rewards we as a team are going to get. Here's the why. Oh, by the way, we need you to work 20 extra hours to get there. There's such a different level of commitment and buy-in when people understand your why and your motivator, so they can get in line with that. But you have to declare it for them to do that.
Precisely. I love that. And the whole idea is that, you know, if there's no involvement, there's going to be no commitment. But if you involve people in the problem and the opportunity, then you can work out the solution together, and you have far greater commitment.
It's interesting, too, because I love the way that you're describing this really applies to every area of your life. You know, we're talking about it in the context of businesses, but I do a lot of coaching with people on life balance and money. Obviously, that's a big thing that we're about here. But if you were to apply this principle of declaring your intent and involving participation from people around you, those same results you're talking about in a business would also be true at home with your setting your family budget, or with your team when you're getting buy-in on a new initiative, or even with, maybe sitting down with your spouse on your calendar, like, hey, this next month I'm going to be traveling a lot, but here's what we can do together. What are your thoughts? And you both become participants in the plan rather than one person in the family or one person in the budget meeting or one person in the business dictating, as you said. You know, you're going to get these higher results because everyone feels bought in and a participant in the conversation.
Yep, exactly. In fact, that's a great test of how you're knowing that you're dealing with fundamental principles. The principles apply at multiple levels. You can apply it in a business, you can apply it in your personal life, your family life, in your community life. And exactly what you said, this whole idea of declaring intent, is there anything more important than with your family than that?
Right.
Let people know kind of why you're doing what you're doing, what your agenda is, what your motive is. Because same way at home, people will wonder and question and sometimes assume differently. And don't have people guessing. Declare it. Involve them. And it's amazing what that does. I try to do that very thing with my kids. I travel a lot as part of my job, but I up front will say, hey, here's what's happening, kids. Here's where I'm going. Here's why I'm doing this. And love to have you come along. And I try to involve them and have them pick a trip or two or three to come along with. And And, you know, where would you like to go? And my dad did that with me. You know, my dad wrote The Seven Habits of Highly Effective People, and he was gone a lot. But as a kid growing up, it never felt that way because he involved us. And we felt like we were part of what he was doing, part of his mission. And then he'd take us on trips, but he'd let us pick the trip. And that alone made a big difference. So I've tried to pass that on to my kids and involve them with it, let them feel like they're part of the mission, and then let them pick trips to come along with. And then we always make sure those trips, we not only do the business piece, but we have personal fun time together and go see Disneyland or whatever it is, wherever they go, and that type of thing. They really turn it into a positive. But the principle is, you know, involve people in the problem / opportunity and then work out the solution together. You just get different and kind outcomes.
Yeah, and I love that example. What a powerful example of you and your father and how he involved you. I think that's so important for these business leaders because a lot of times it's easy as entrepreneurs to feel pulled in multiple competing directions, but you can actually, yep. Those things are interconnected and you can weave them together strategically to involve your family in your business stuff, to have, you know, this really nice tapestry of your whole life that they're not polar opposites competing all the time, that it's an intentional strategy on your part to involve them as participants in every aspect of your life. I love that. Love that example.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And that, you know, that's never more important than for entrepreneurs because the business can consume them.
Yes.
And I've been there and I understand it and it does consume you. And yet you've got other important dimensions. And usually the entrepreneurs trying to create the business in order to provide for their family and to do great things with them. And
right.
But sometimes you can lose yourself in that process. And so the more you involve people in that, including your own family, and declare your intent and give the why behind the what, you'll get greater commitment, greater buy-in. And then, ironically, you'll get greater results, too, because
right.
You'll tap into people's creativity and their energy and their passions, and they'll be on board with you. And, you know, it's a balancing act. But it's true in life. It's true in business. I think of a person that's done this extremely well, an entrepreneur, Tony Hsieh,
mm-hmm.
apples.com. You know, and what a success story. They went from, what, zero to $1 billion in revenue.
That's just incredible.
In 4 or 5 years, and selling shoes online and other things. But Tony Hsieh, right up front, declared his intent. You know, first of all, the overall premise of Zappos, they said, was to deliver happiness.
Mm.
You know, that was their mission. That was their mantra, deliver happiness. And that included to their customers, but also to their own people. Deliver happiness. That's what they're all about. But then Tony made two decisions, and he declared it. First, I'm going to trust my customers. And second, I'm going to trust my own people.
Mm.
And then that got manifest in the culture and in the practices that they put in place, their policies. So trust their customers. He said, we're going to offer free shipping both ways. You know, they're selling shoes online. And it's not hard to envision how someone could abuse that, right? You
right.
know, order 100 pair of shoes, send back 99. That's going to be pretty expensive when you're paying the shipping both ways. But people like being trusted. The customers like being trusted, and they didn't abuse it. And very rarely did they ever find that they had to talk to a customer to say, hey, maybe don't quite order so many to test. But very rarely, customers like being trusted, and they responded to that. They stayed loyal, and they referred business to them, and they stayed very loyal to them. Same thing happened with their own people. He said, we're going to trust our people. See, he's declaring his intent. And then that got manifest in the culture with practices and policies and procedures and systems. Like their call centers, they have no scripts. And they're not timing their calls. They're not trying to be efficient. They're saying, hey, deliver happiness. Take care of the customer. We trust you. We're going to train you really well. And we trust you to do the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
And use your judgment. And it's amazing. They feel that trust. They respond to it. They give it back. And they have happy employees, happy customers, and they're getting great results. Tony Hsieh up front has declared his intent. He involves people in it, and they respond to it. They like being trusted. They mm-hmm. respond to the trust. They perform better. And his own people build trust with their customers. And that becomes that self-fulfilling prophecy and the virtuous upward cycle. So this stuff really works as a leader.
That's really powerful. And I think for our business leaders listening, for them to understand that trust is not a theory, it's not a feeling, it's a tangible business principle that has results as you're describing. But what I'd also like is that it's really a choice. You know, there's a choice to believe. And you talk about the three beliefs about trust. And it's interesting because I do a lot of coaching, like I said, and what I try to walk people through is their beliefs shape their values and their values shape their actions. And but many people think, well, I can't change my beliefs. But the way that you describe it, you can choose to believe in trust. That's a choice that you make, that you actually make that choice to believe the best. And, you know, I could see some of our listeners saying, oh, I'm a realist, or, oh, you know, I've been burned. But what we're saying is, it's not something you do when you're feeling trusting or when the situation feels right. It's a choice to choose. Your baseline is to assume the best. Your baseline is to believe in being worthy of trust, a belief that most people can be trusted, a belief that extending trust is the best way to lead, as you describe it, through your three beliefs. And all that starts with a choice to believe in that, right?
Absolutely. In fact, that's in the book, Smart Trust. That is the very first action. I give five actions of Smart Trust. The very first action is the choice, the decision to believe, you know, choose to believe in trust, that it's a better way to live, it's a better way to lead, that most people are worthy of it, or that most people can be trusted, not all, but most people, and that there's that being worthy of trust pays dividends.
Right.
Pays off. And that is a mindset. It is a decision, a choice. Mm. And when leaders start with that, see, Tony Hsieh started with that. He basically said, I choose to believe in trust. I choose to trust my customers. Now, think about it. Couldn't you imagine someone saying, hey, people are going to take advantage of that. Free shipping both ways?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
You know, people are going to abuse that, take advantage. But he says, no, I choose to believe my customers that most people won't. There might be a one or two or, you know, 10 or who knows, 100. But he's got thousands, if not millions of customers, and he's choosing to believe in it. And that's a choice. He does the same thing with his people. I choose to trust my people. And we're not going to have scripts. We're not going to time them. And again, the traditional thinking is you got to control your people and someone's going to get out of line and take advantage. But he chooses to trust his people. And that's it's a philosophy. It's a choice, to your point, a decision that they make to say, we can trust our people. We do trust our people. We choose to trust our people. And we believe it will bring out the best in them, that most people are worthy of it. And then if you build a high trust culture, the culture itself will kind of weed out, crowd out, starve out those violators that maybe take advantage and just goof off instead of working on stuff. And because it's their peers that say, hey, you know, get working on stuff that matters, because no one wants to lose that kind of trust.
And I like your example, too, about how the team members will start to protect that. We definitely experience that here in our company, in the Lampo Group, where Dave may push the first domino down, but the subsequent effects of how we as a team protect our culture, we protect the trust, we protect the no gossip, all of the things that make us who we are, we as a team take ownership in that. And we love that, and we won't let anything in that comes against that. And so when you kind of initiate this trust culture and you create it intentionally, your team becomes protectors of it. So you don't have to micromanage, you don't have to weed out everything yourself, because the team starts to do that for you because they appreciate it and want to protect it as well. And I love that example because they really become participants, as you described it. And, you know, you talk in this book again and again about the difference between blind trust and smart trust. So let's just talk about that for a second, because even as we're diving in and describing this, I could still see the people that are the realists, the people that are saying, well, I've been burned, or I'll just be taken advantage of. What define for me a little bit the difference between smart trust, as you describe it, and blind trust, so they can understand how to implement this practically, even if maybe they've had a bad experience in their past.
Yeah. It's a great point, because so many people say, hey, I trusted and I got burned and it's just too risky. And so I'm saying, look, it's not a one size fits all. So here, let me describe two extremes. Here's one extreme. One extreme is what we might call blind trust. And blind trust is when you kind of just indiscriminately trust anyone and everyone. And that's not smart, not in today's world, because not everyone can be trusted.
Right.
If you just kind of trust everyone regardless of the circumstance and the risk and everything, at some point you're going to get burned and you'll probably regret it. So I'm acknowledging to just trust everyone, you can be too trusting, you know, that's not going to work in today's world. But neither will the other extreme. The other extreme is where you don't trust anyone because of the fact that you can't trust some.
Right.
And see, many managers fall into that trap, Christy, where they maybe trusted people somewhere along the way, got burned at some point, and now have kind of swung the pendulum to the other side where they say, hey, I just don't trust anyone but myself.
Right.
It's just too risky to trust other people. And there's some truth to that, in that there is risk in trusting people, but there's also risk in not trusting people, because when you don't trust people, you don't even see the possibilities. You don't empower, you don't engage, you don't tap into their potential, you don't see the possibilities. And so that extreme is not going to work either in a world in which we work with people. We're interdependent. We collaborate, partner, and team. If you don't trust people, you'll never be a great collaborator and partner and teammate, right, and leader. And so neither extreme is going to serve you well. But the idea of smart trust is that there's a third alternative between these two extremes. It says start with a high propensity to trust. By propensity to trust, I mean a desire to trust, a willingness to trust, an inclination. That's the choice, which is I'd like to trust as a leader. I'd like to trust my team, my people, my customers. It's a better starting point. I want to trust. But the second piece, I call that propensity to trust. You want that to be high. But you also got to balance that with equally high analysis. That flows from your head. See, the propensity to trust flows from your heart.
That's good.
And it's a blending of heart with head. Propensity to trust with analysis, heart with head. And my head says, hey, I also, though, have got to be smart about it, so I got to assess, what's the situation? What am I considering trusting people in? What's the risk involved? Another, you know, how risky is it? And what's the credibility of the people involved? And, you know, how well do I know them? How credible are they? And I'll tell you what, if there's really high risk in something and kind of low credibility or maybe unknown credibility of the people, I'm going to be far more careful, cautious, right, in how much trust I give. But the fact that I start with the propensity of trust means I'm open. I'm looking for possibilities. I'm looking to say, hey, I'd like to trust, but I need to see a little bit more demonstration that you're worthy of it. You're ready for it. But you're always seeking to create it and to grow it and to build it versus just not being even open to it where you find all the reasons why you can't trust anything.
Right.
And so it's a third alternative that balances the risk with the possibilities that flow from high trust, and it's a way of navigating with, you know, with high trust in a low trust world where you minimize the risk and maximize the possibilities. And it's not a one size fits all because the risk might be so great. I'll give you an example. I was with some Navy admirals, including the admiral of a nuclear submarine. So he says, "Look, I'm the admiral of a nuclear submarine, and we have protocols to do anything on our ship, on our boat. And if people want to go to the restroom, there's a protocol for the process of doing anything on our boat. Are you suggesting to me," he asked, "that I should get rid of these protocols? That I'm showing that I don't trust my people?" And I said, "No, not at all, because you've got a nuclear submarine.
Right.
You know, the risk is pretty high.
That's serious.
For a nuclear submarine." And so you're going to be more careful, more cautious about how much trust you'll give out there because you don't want that to go wrong. It's too high risk. But most of life, most of business is not nuclear submarines.
Right.
And I compare that to, you know, to the story I tell of a street vendor selling donuts and coffee to people as they go into an office complex and he's got this bottleneck of making change for his people. You know, and people leave the line, they grow impatient from the wait, and he says, "You know what? I'm going to trust my customer. I'm going to put a little basket, and I'm going to put some dollar bills and $5 bills and quarters in the basket, and let them make their own change." And the customer comes through, and he serves them donuts and coffee, and the customer reaches out to pay him, and he says, "Hey, you make your own change." So the customer goes down to the end of the cart, and on their own, they make their own change. Now look, there's a little bit of risk in that, right? Because maybe the customer makes the wrong change, But the thing is, though, he got rid of the bottleneck because when trust goes up, speed goes up, cost goes down, and suddenly the street vendor could put through twice as many customers as he could before.
That's good.
He never lacked for customers. They were growing impatient and leave because they didn't want to wait any longer. Now his throughput is twice as fast, twice as many customers. He had no new cost in doing this, and here's what he discovered. Rather than people abusing the trust that he gave to him, take advantage of him, he found just the opposite. They liked being trusted. They came back to him more frequently. They gave him larger than normal tips, and he literally more than doubled his business by simply extending trust to his customer. Now, someone might say, "Well, there was a risk, but look at the risk. The risk is not that great. You know, maybe the customer, worst case, runs off with the basket and takes the money. More likely, maybe they accidentally make some wrong change." But he found just the opposite. People liked being trusted; they gave him more. But the risk was really pretty low. So I frame that as two extremes. Okay, is it nuclear submarines, where very high risk, or is it the donut guy, where you might have $10-$20 at most in that basket, pretty moderate, pretty low risk, and and everything in between. And so Smart Trust is saying, hey, it's not a one-size-fits-all, but if you start with the propensity to trust, flowing from your heart, and you're open to that, and then you add to it your analysis flowing from your head, where you assess the risk and the situation and the credibility, you're going to make good decisions, good judgments. But what you'll find yourself is more often finding ways to create trust with people, finding ways to extend trust because you know that's a better way to lead. It's just that you're going to be smart about
right.
it, not blind about it. That's the idea.
Well, and it seems like, too, everything we're describing here is really the complete polar opposite of what I see really often just in the marketplace is a fear-based leadership. And we're saying this is the complete opposite. We're going to trust. We're going to make the choice that our baseline is believing the best in others. We're going to make the choice to have wisdom in our analysis. It makes me think of Dave does a great lesson in our Entree Leadership Master Series event where he talks about delegation. And this is a tough thing, like you said, for entrepreneurs because they don't want to give up control. They have a tendency to micromanage because no one can do it better than they can. And it's a tough thing because they have such investment and ownership in this thing they've created. But he describes raising his kids and uses this example of a rope. He uses an analogy of a rope of when the kids made good decisions, he would extend the rope and there was more trust and more leverage and more opportunity for them. But whenever they made bad decisions, and this is the wisdom and analysis, he would pull the rope back in and you had to, you know, stay a little bit closer and didn't get as much responsibility. But it's such a good example that really applies to these business leaders because that is a huge hurdle, whether it's through delegation or trusting their team or trusting in the marketplace. That's a real challenge because they feel so invested. They feel so involved in their business and what they've created. But what you're saying is this is a choice and it really is the wiser choice, even though it may be the tougher choice. It seems in the time and in the situation probably, but it's going to produce those results you talk about. There's one other thing I want to touch on because I know we're running out of time, but I want to get to this before we wrap up. You talk in the book about constant opportunity and constant challenge. And so if a business leader is thinking about how to apply this to their life, I like how you describe that everything you're doing, you're either building trust or breaking it down. Talk to me a little bit about that idea.
Yeah, see, this is, you don't ever fully and finally arrive.
Right.
It's ongoing. And we've got to constantly behave our way into trust, or we can behave our way out of it. And if you think you've arrived and that, you know, you're trusted, but then you're not aware of your behavior, you might find that you start spinning things or start operating with hidden agendas, and suddenly you'll be diminishing the trust. But if we see this as a constant opportunity that we're always trying to behave in ways that grow trust, you know, get results in a way that inspire trust, that increases our ability to get results the next time and the next time. And there's always a next time. But if you get results in a way that diminish the trust because you maybe cut corners or maybe you're spinning, maybe you're over-promising, under-delivering, and you got the result but the trust went down, then the next time you try to get results is a little bit harder. It'll take you longer, cost you more. People don't fully believe what you're saying. And this is an ongoing process. We're always in this game. And that, you know, that's what leadership is about. So I see leadership as this. Leadership is getting results in a way that inspires trust. Because then your ability to get results the next time has just gone up. And another way of putting it is this. How we do what we do makes all the difference. And if you get results in a way that diminishes the trust, then your ability to get results the next time has just gone down. And you know, how you did it, it came at a price,
right.
at a cost. And so it is a constant opportunity, a constant challenge in either direction. But ultimately, Christy, it gets manifest in the behavior. Are we behaving ourselves in ways that will build a trust? And in the Speed of Trust book, I identify, you know, the 13 behaviors that are common to high trust leaders. And from the hundreds of behaviors that are out there, we've culled down and identified the most high leverage behaviors. The Pareto 80-20 rule. You know, these are the highest leverage behaviors to help leaders build trust. And they're deliberate. They're specific. Things like talk straight, create transparency, right wrongs, clarify expectations, deliver results, listen first, keep commitments, extend trust. Anyway, there's 13 of these high leverage behaviors that if you do those things and behave in those ways, you'll move the needle on trust. And that constant opportunity and the constant challenge, you'll be winning that battle and you'll be building the trust and getting the results. But if you do the opposite of those behaviors, you know, the opposite of talking straight is to lie, more likely the counterfeit of those behaviors, the counterfeit is to talk straight is to spin. And, you know, so the counterfeit works. Spinning works, but it comes at a price. Right. There's collateral damage. Trust goes down. And so you might feel like, hey, you know, I kind of had to finesse it, spin it. But the next time you communicate to someone, they're saying, I'm not quite sure if I believe what they're saying, because they always spin. Far better to talk straight, tell the truth, call things what they are, use simple language. Candor is a language of trust. So that's what I mean by how we do what we do. It's through our behavior. Our behavior. There's 13 high trust behaviors. There's 13 counterfeits that will cause us to lose that trust. And that's the constant opportunity. That's the constant challenge, is to behave ourselves in trust. And if you model it as a leader first, and then help build a culture where you know, culture is how most of the people, what they think and say and behave most of the time. And you're trying to get them to behave in ways that grow trust, and they can have that become the behavioral norm. Then you'll build a high-trust culture, and that's a culture of immense momentum and possibilities, and they'll get better results. But you model it as a leader, and you help build those expectations as a team in the culture, and you'll get great results, both for yourself, but also for your entire organization. And that's what leadership is about, getting results in a way that inspires trust.
Well, and I think, too, I love what you said, where one of the things I've seen in my own life about this idea of results is often I will do things that I think are the right thing to do, but it actually produces results I don't want. And so I think that when some of these counterfeits you're talking about, they may work temporarily, and then later it's difficult to get trust, but even immediately you may not get the results that you want. And so one of the examples that came to mind, because I think all of this, like we said, applies to personal as well as professional. It applies to your family relationships as well as your business and your team and your relationship there. But this idea of constant challenge. So when I was thinking through this, kind of prepping for our call today, I thought of an example where you said, you know, we're always either building it up or breaking it down. Well, in an example with my husband and I, I'm very high D. I'm like 99% D, 99% I, very low S and C on the DISC profile. Well, a lot of our business leaders, we have a lot of high D people, so I'm talking to you guys out there. One of the things that's natural for our personality style is to react. Immediately, if something seems like we're being attacked or something seems negative, we react. We become defensive and we go into attack mode. That's kind of how we handle conflict, how we defend ourselves, and that's kind of our natural go-to. Well, high S and high C people, they don't like conflict, and that can be very scary. It can be intimidating, and it can make them shut down. So in my marriage, for example, with my husband, Matt, I may say, yeah, I really want you to tell me when something's wrong. And then the next time that he brings me something that hurt his feelings or made him mad or whatever I did wrong, and I flip out on him, I have taught him that I can't handle it. I have broken the trust where next time he's not going to bring it to me. So I may say, yeah, I really want you to be honest. Yeah, I want you to bring me feedback of how I can be a better wife. Yeah, I want you to tell me when I've done something wrong. But by my actions, I communicated that I couldn't handle that, or I don't really want him to. And so I'm not going to get the results I want of him bringing me feedback. And I see that with business leaders a lot that may say, yeah, I want my team to be honest with me. I want their honest feedback about how I can lead them better. And then a team member brings them something that, you know, they think could have been done better. And the business leader owner flips out. You know, they attack them, they scream, they cause a scene, they embarrass the team member in front of other people. Well, that team member's never going to bring them something again. You have broken the trust with that person or in your marriage or whatever relationship. And so I love that example of the constant opportunity, constant challenge, because it's really a good idea in theory to say, I'm going to have actions that build trust. But sometimes, whether it's negative feedback or criticism or you know, something that feels like it hurts your pride as a leader or your ego, it's difficult to walk that out sometimes. But I think it's good for us to be cognizant and aware of. So next time my husband brings me something and my feelings are hurt and I want to defend myself, I just take a deep breath and say, okay, I'm really glad you told me that. How could I have done that better? You know, and dig in a little bit deeper. That builds trust, so next time he feels comfortable bringing it to me.
There's great illustrations, both the personal one with, you know, receiving feedback from your husband, and then also the team one for a leader, getting feedback from a team, because you're exactly right. See, that's behavior. That you're calling it actions, behavior, how we do what we do, and that will reinforce it in either direction, like you said, where your husband won't come forward, talk to you about it, because they saw how the response was, or they'll do it again, and same with the leader. It not only will that person not give feedback to the leader, neither will anybody else on the team, and they'll be afraid to it. And that's the real culture. It's not what the value statement of the company that sits on the wall says, you know, we value continuous improvement. It's what the culture says of how we respond and the behaviors. And if people are defensive and reactive and attack back and attack the messenger, then that's the real culture. That's the real value, not the platitude that's on the mission statement, but it's what the culture does, the behavior. And that's where leaders, they set the tone right at the top, and they model it. And it doesn't mean you have to be perfect. That's the good news, because none of us are. And one of the behaviors, by the way, that builds trust is to right wrongs. And so you make it right, you make it right when you're wrong. You make a mistake, okay, you know, I was wrong, I apologize. And I realize that that's not how I want to respond, and so I'll try better next time. And you try to behave your way back into trust.
Right.
My father had a great expression where he said, you can't talk yourself out of a problem that you behaved yourself into.
That's good. Somebody tweet that. That's really good.
We've lost someone's trust through our behavior. Words alone won't get it back. Now we got to behave our way out of it. And so our behavior matters. The words might help. You know, maybe an apology, that's going to help. But ultimately, people need to see us behave our way back into trust. And that's the constant opportunity. That's the constant challenge, is that it ultimately comes down to our behavior. But I'm an optimist about it. And I believe that, look, we start with a level of trust, but in the same way that you can diminish trust in your behavior, you can also consciously, deliberately create it, grow it, expand it through your behavior. And that's part of the speed of trust, both the fact that you can move faster when you have it, but also the idea that when you understand certain behaviors, build it, and do those behaviors, manifest them, you can build it faster than you thought was possible. And that's exciting. And it helps leaders at any level to say, hey, I can operate with trust and get better results with greater speed, lower cost.
That's so good. And I think one of the key themes that we see in all of our podcasts, but specifically today, is it starts with you. It starts with the business leader. You're always teaching people by your actions how to treat you. And so if you as a leader are surrounded by people that tiptoe around you, a good question to ask is, how are you behaving that has taught them that they have to tiptoe around you? This has given us so many good principles, but also practical application of how to live this out, how to train our mind, make choices, believe in trust, all of these things that are going to have tangible bottom line results, which is what the entrepreneur wants. But it starts with our behavior and our choices. And all of this is outlined in more detail in your book, Smart Trust. And this has been so helpful for me, Stephen. I could talk to you all day about this, honestly. This has really been fun for me. And so where can we, would you have a website that I can direct people to find out more information about you and your book and all of your initiatives?
Yeah. Yeah. Go to, myspeedoftrust.com.
Okay.
Myspeedoftrust.com. And there's a variety of tools there and processes that people can get good at. You can get the books, Smart Trust and the Speed of Trust books. And there's a variety of different tools and resources for people. Myspeedoftrust.com. And I will also, in my conclusion, I agree with what you just said. It starts with each of us. It starts with each leader. It's an inside-out process. And it takes two to have trust, but it only takes one to start. And our leaders can be that one. They can be the catalyst to inspire trust and to extend trust in a smart way. I just returned from India where I was reminded of the great quote by Gandhi. He said, "Let us become the change that we seek in this world." Don't wait on anybody else. Let us become it. To that, I amend or I add to it and say, let us create the trust that we seek in our teams, in our relationships, in our organizations. We can be the creators of it. We can initiate it. We can choose to believe in it. We can extend it smartly, and we can be the catalyst that helps make it happen. So let us create the trust that we seek in our world.
I love it. This is so good. Well, I hope you guys are taking notes, because I've got a ton here in front of me, and this has helped me personally, and I know that it has really made a difference for our business leaders as well, because we're all every day having this opportunity and this challenge that you're talking about. So hopefully many of them will pick up the book, Smart Trust, and I love the way it's described, the defining skill that transforms managers into leaders. And that's what we all want to be. We want to be great leaders. So Stephen, thank you so much for taking time out of your day. This has been very enlightening for me, and I know it's made a difference in our community as well. So I really appreciate you being with us today.
Absolutely, Christy. I'm delighted to be a part of it, and I admire you and Dave and the entire Entre Leadership community for what you're doing. Great work.
Wonderful. Well, thanks so much. We'll talk to you later.
Okay, take care.
All right, you too. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Wow, I don't know about you all, but that was so helpful for me. It's interesting to see how in his book and even in this conversation, Stephen takes this idea of trust, this idea that we're probably all really familiar with, but probably just overlook in a day-to-day business life, and really builds it out and shows how there's tangible results associated with trust or a lack of trust in organization. He gives numbers and bottom line results that we can see if we intentionally create this positive trust culture. And then he makes it very applicable. He gives us steps and ways to implement it in our businesses and also, like I said, in our home life, because this idea of trust really affects every relationship that you have, whether that's at home or in the office. So I really appreciate him being here. I know that was helpful for you guys and helpful for me as well. And as always, you can get more information just like this, some great content and articles. We've got videos and coaching tips on our website, entreleadership.com. And we encourage you to join the conversation there with other entrepreneurs and leaders all over the country. Stay plugged into this Entree Leadership stuff. Keep learning and keep leading. Until next time, grow yourself, grow your team, grow your profits.